This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Tom Birchfield. How are you, Tom?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Good. Last interview, we've been talking about LiveX, and we've talked with you recently about what's been going on in the on-premier market and what's going on in the fine wine market. But I just wanted to talk a wee bit about the wider fine wine market, because you're seeing changes all over the place. We'll start with Bordeaux, though, because I think the wines that get all the noise are the Cru Class A. And I've been really enjoying Cru Bourgeois. I mean, you get a lot of wine for your buck. You bang for your buck. It really delivers. And you, if you like Bordeaux and you just want that really nice Bordeaux style of wine, there's some great wines that are under a 20 quid, you know, 15 quid, 20 quid sort of thing. How is the fine wine, the volatility or the changes in the fine wine market affecting the Cru Bourgeois guys? And just for the listeners at home, Cru Bourgeois is a tier lower than Bordeaux. It goes through a completely different process. It's not based on what happened in 1855. The wines have to be tasted. They have to pass panels, judgment, all this type of thing. So but they're still good quality wines. They're almost like all the good wines that didn't make it into the Cru Class A system.
To be like fully transparent, we don't actually see a huge amount of trade for these on LiveX just yet. Slightly dodged the question, but I would say what we are seeing an interesting evolution in Bordeaux, when we talk about sort of how Bordeaux wines are bought and sold and traded, etc., is the expansion of what they call hors Bordeaux, or the beyond Bordeaux wines that are released via La Place de Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. So these are sort of generally sort of international wines, which are now being distributed through the traditional sort of Bordelais system. Yeah. So they get released in, when is it, sort of March time and September time. Mm-hmm. Tend to see a few sort of Italian wines, US wines, some champagne that are...
Some New Zealand wines going in there as well.
Yeah, these categories have expanded massively in recent years. There's hundreds of wines that now come through these sort of release windows at those times of year. From what we can see, there isn't a huge amount of demand across the board. Bordeaux or La Place, that distribution system, as I mentioned, is a distribution system. It's optimized sort of for distributing across the world. It's not necessarily a mechanism for building brands. So the ones that have done well, releasing via La Place, you know, historically sort of Opus One, which has actually removed itself now, if I'm not mistaken, you know, that was actually, you know, it's been around for a long time. That has an established brand that did well via La Place. But I think it's a harder sell for some of these other wines. I think it's an interesting one. I'm not sure what the Bordeaux producers think about all these other countries sort of muscling in on their thing.
And as you're saying, they're adding wines from all over the world going through that system, which gives you international distribution.
Yeah.
So if you're a high quality producer in America or New Zealand or Australia or wherever you are, and you want to get international distribution of your wines without necessarily setting up a wholesaler in each individual country, you can hit the top suppliers who supply, you might be able to hit the top restaurants and the top whatever it is all over the world in one step. So that's the attraction, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It could be incredibly expensive to build all of that up off your own back. Mm-hmm. I think from a merchant's perspective, so the negotiation will sell on to the sort of the end merchants and then sell on to the consumers. It can be quite a lot for them to sort of keep track of. You know, Bordeaux and Primeur, as an example, you know, you get like sometimes up to 10 wines being released every day. It's a hell of a lot to keep on track of and to build a story and then sell that on to your customers by whatever means. Having the same for a whole new sort of two categories of wines coming out in March and September, as a merchant, it can be actually a really hard thing to sort of keep on top of. You know, you get wines all being released at the same time, merchants don't really know what to do. But yeah, returning to your original point sort of around, I guess, distribution systems, I'm not sure. Maybe we will see more sort of what direct-to-consumer models popping up in future. But yeah, the sort of the Bordeaux mechanism is designed for distribution. It makes perfect sense why people would want to make most of that.
Is there any particular countries that are really getting involved in this La Place de Bordeaux situation?
Well, mostly you'd think of it as sort of Tuscany. And in some ways, Tuscan wine, if there's any I always struggle with sort of calling other regions and other countries the Burgundy of this country or the border of that. But sort of Tuscany is kind of Italy's version of Tuscany to some degree. You have people like Sassicaia. So yeah, those wines have fared pretty well. In terms of sort of the wider proliferation or expansion of the market, the fine wine market, by the way, is the broadest it's ever been. 12,000 individual wines were traded on LiveX last year from about 5,000 brands, and it just continues to grow.
Yeah.
Bordeaux's share has fallen from about 80% 25 years ago to 35% last year.
But that's not because Bordeaux is shrinking. It's mainly because the other products are coming in.
A bit of both. Yeah. But sort of where we are seeing expansion is, for example, Spain. I think, you know, there's a huge amount of untapped, or should we say, wines still to be discovered by the secondary market. Last year, so LiveX every year publishes its Power 100, which looks at a bunch of different parameters at a producer level. And last year, Vega Sicilia was the number one on the Power 100. This is the first time a Spanish wine had done that.
From Ribera del Duero.
Yeah.
and only a DO, not a DOCA as well. Yeah. I've always think Ribera del Duero should be a DOCA, personally.
Yeah. Spain looks to be a region that, well, is it flying under the radar? Potentially not. There's a lot of discoveries still to be made. I think interesting things is that we're seeing increasing trade for lower price categories, which I think is an interesting thing. People, I think, sort of imagine that on LiveX, it's just the first growths, the top Grand Cru from Burgundy, you know, the very starriest sort of Solos and everything coming out of Champagne. It is that, but there's also a hell of a lot of lower price trade. People like Produturi from Barbaresco. You know, these wines which could be classed as sort of everyday within the context of fine wine. You know, they're not the cheapest wine. Yeah, but in the context of fine wine, they are towards the lower end of things. And we are seeing an expansion of, you know, that type of trade. We're seeing increased demand for South African wine, Australian wine, all starting from a pretty low level.
Yeah, yeah.
But they will start to get in on the act.
You think about Australia, and Australia does have some quite, I don't know if they're investable, but you've got Henschke and you've got Penfolds Grange. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some pretty gutsy producers who have solid international reputations.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because they have all of the credentials that you think logically should make them collectible. Not sure about investable, but collectible. You know, they have the brand, they have the quality, they have the heritage, all of those things. For example, Vega Sicilia, by the way, also has all of those things. And I think that's what's helped it sort of perform well over the past couple of years. And also it's at a price point which is not as astronomical as other fine wines. It's always tricky calling a fine wine affordable. but you know, it's what, probably about half the price of a Bordeaux first growth. The critical thing we keep saying is that these sort of the fine wines which tend to be performing well at the moment are at a price point which invite people not just to buy it, but actually drink it.
Yeah.
And that's not just so you can get people excited about a brand or a wine, but it also sort of balances out the supply and demand. You know, there's a real problem with that at the moment. But if you can get people drinking the wines, reducing that supply, then that sort of means that the prices will be more stable. You can be more confident as a buyer, etc.
Actually, that's interesting because it has, one of the things that we talked about was in Bordeaux on Pommier, the increase in the number of investors into the market are people who are not necessarily drinking the wines, and they're investing for, well, they were trying to invest for profit,
yeah.
But they weren't necessarily drinking the wines, and therefore you didn't get that sort of decrease in supply over time because they just weren't drinking them. Whereas these other more readily accessible fine wines are they're for drinking.
Yeah. Sorry. So what was the exact question there?
No, I suppose one of the reasons that Bordeaux could be in problems is because people aren't necessarily drinking them anymore. They're just investing in them.
Yeah.
And so you're not getting that decrease in supply, you know, 10 years down the track because they're just holding on to them and then releasing them back onto the market. And then, hey, there's almost as much supply as there was when we first bought the wines.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know off the top of my head sort of what percentage of Bordeaux purchasing or purchasing from any region would be sitting on the balance sheet of an investment company rather than of a consumer that might actually drink it. That's a really interesting point. I would sort of counter that by saying if you look at, for example, Burgundy, which does you know, it's much smaller production and should to some degree be sort of sheltered from that. You know, it should be consumed more. There should be less of it knocking about and its prices should be more stable. We haven't necessarily seen that at the moment. But that's a really interesting point, actually. I think in terms of the Bordeaux Legends 40, we track the performance of those back vintage Bordeaux where there is less of it knocking about compared to recent Bordeaux. And we see that those prices are much more stable.
Yeah.
Because there is consumption-induced scarcity. If investors release a load of back vintage Bordeaux when they're looking to liquidate, what's that going to do to the market?
You mentioned Spain and Tuscany as two regions of interest. Is there any wines that are sort of at the entry level of the investable market that produce, you know, really high credit scores and they're just not getting traction, you know? And if you're a drinker, not an investor, but you want to drink really nice wines, what regions or producers would you sort of say, look, take a look at these?
Oh, interesting. So getting on to, I guess, sort of personal recommendations about sort of what I drink, perhaps.
Well, yeah, maybe, but not necessarily what you necessarily drink, but you must talk to people about things.
Well, one category that I would talk about would be Chianti Classico. I think it's an absolutely delicious wine. The ratings would also say so. The ratings would say that it is perhaps chronically undervalued compared to Brunello. I think you can get some absolutely brilliant Chianti Classico. You know, they've got the Gran Selezione sort of category, which is appears to be gaining traction.
That's quite new, though, the Gran Selezione. It's only about 5 years old, isn't it?
Yeah, it is pretty new, and it's sort of taking that Burgundy model of not just making a Chianti Classico, or making a Chianti Classico from this specific vineyard because of blah, 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 blah. And there appear to be some really great wines at not astronomic prices. I think that from there are still a sort of opportunities for not necessarily what I would drink on as an everyday wine, but as a sort of an entry point into sort of to get you excited about, you know, what fine wine can do and be. That would be where I would maybe start. I think in Spain, you know, you've got incredible wines being made across Spain. You know, it's massive. I think there are some delicious wines being coming out of Tenerife, for example, from Commando G and people like that just outside Madrid. Like, fine wines, and I think they're entry-level cuvées. If I was going to start a collection, that might be where I would look. I think I would also look potentially, I think there are some discoveries to be made in Piedmont. That's where I would look, sort of maybe Barbaresco.
Yeah, Barbaresco is a Barolo lookalike.
But yeah, I think it's in terms of the market as a whole, it is broadening, and it will continue to broaden. That's, to some degree, you know, that's kind of the problem with sort of the incumbent fine wine regions is that you have, okay, if you can buy like a delicious Oregon Pinot Noir for half the price of a similar, it's not the same thing because you can buy a delicious bottle of wine from over there at half the price. You might just give it a chance.
Yeah.
And then you might get addicted to buying Oregon Pinot Noir instead of, you know, wherever in Burgundy. I think as a consumer, as a buyer, these are great things. And this is why it's sort of an interesting time to be part of the market. But I think for those incumbent regions, this is the challenge that you have, is that you have at the moment a dwindling level of demand and you have so much more competition, great wine being made wherever at the moment, prices which make them appealing options.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. We talked a lot about LiveX and trading wines, but usually in my mind, anyway, you can correct me if I'm wrong, wines that are liquid and tradable for me are like 10 years after release. And then when the supply dwindles, the wines move to being the price discovery, because there's less being traded. You don't really know what the price is because they may not be traded every week or every month or even every year. And so the way to get correct price discovery is through auctions. What's been happening in the auction market? Has it been reflecting the sort of the more index-driven market?
It is interesting. I would actually challenge that slightly, because what we see in our secondary market trading data is actually a lot less variability in transaction prices compared to hammer prices in an auction. Depending on the day, depending on the crowd, etc., you see huge amounts of difference in auction prices. Mm-hmm. So actually, I would slightly challenge that sort of the way to sort of value older fine wine is via auctions. Lots of the time, actually, our data sort of stands slightly at sort of counter, sort of at loggerheads to to what the auction market has been seeing. Again, sort of my take on this is that there can be a lot of variability in what happens in an auction given a specific day, whereas the sort of the consistency, and I think perhaps because of the anonymity of, for example, LiveX, you have a much more sort of rational and sort of data-driven way of buying, where you sort of take the emotion, or you take someone sitting next to you hammering up the price, you sort of take that away. And I think you get, in my opinion, you might get towards a more true reflection of what the current price is of a wine. I'm not trying to just push the LiveX.
Could you say that?
Yeah.
Yeah, those auctions, they're not a clear market signal.
No, the two have to coexist. And they do coexist, and I wouldn't like to comment too much on that.
Okay, now that's cool. Final question for you.
Yeah.
Do you collect or invest in wine, or do you drink it, or are you teetotal? What's your situation there?
I'm definitely not teetotal. I don't invest in wine. I collect a little bit. I drink.
See, there's a difference, isn't there? There's collecting and investing.
Yeah. I buy wine fundamentally because I want to drink it rather than think of it as a long-term investment. I perhaps don't have the patience for that. I guess the regions or the wines that I drink, actually, to flag, and LiveX colleagues will hate me for this, but I come from the restaurant background. We had a predominantly fine wine list, I used to own a restaurant. So the wines that I like to drink are sort of towards the sort of clean, natural end of the spectrum. People like Guy Bateau in the Loire, sort of Clos Rougeard, people like that, Ganavat. You know, these wines which, when you tell people, oh, you know, they didn't add sulfur at any point in the production, they're like, get away. That's not natural wine because it tastes clean as a whistle. Those are the types of wines that I love to drink. I lived in Italy, so I have a soft spot. I lived in Turin, so I have a soft spot for delicious Barolo and Barbaresco. I think mentioned Produttori. I think that is one of the best value for money wines that you can actually buy. From the straight entry level Barbaresco to the Reservas, I think they are delicious wines that I buy and I drink.
Lovely. All right then, Tom. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.